Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the actor Robert Hardy. His career on stage, TV and film has spanned 60 years.
More.
How many more?
Well, it started in January 1949 at Stratford, so right. My mathematics are not good.
Yes.
So you can work it out from
60
there.
Odd years, shall we say.
Yeah.
I'll go on. The requirements for such enduring success: a certain amount of talent, luck, a spine of steel, he says, and a ruthlessness of mind that does not jib at murder. He studied under C.S. Lewis and Tolkien at Oxford, but after national service left the university with a shabby degree, his words again, along with an ambition to act and a lasting friendship with Richard Burton. He's taken on the great stage roles, including Henry V and Hamlet, and his film credits range from Jane Austen to John le Carré. To the younger audience, he's the Minister of Magic in the Harry Potter films, whilst those of us who are slightly longer in the tooth remember his BAFTA-winning Winston Churchill. But the role that made him a household name was Siegfried Farnan in the hugely popular TV series All Creatures Great and Small. And is it right, Robert Hardy, that when you first read the James Herriot books, you thought a TV adaptation would bore the towns and annoy the country?
Yes, it's exactly what I said.
Yeah, so you were entirely wrong, of course.
Well, I was, thank goodness. And both town and country, in their different ways, it rather enjoyed it.
When did you know you had a hit on your hands?
I don't think the BBC was ever sure they had, because we used to do a year or 9 months, whatever it was, and then there'd be a break while they chewed their fingernails and thought, shall we do some more? But it was wonderful for people like me, because I did a year and then I went off and did something else.
And by the time you got to All Creatures Great and Small, we should remind people, of course, that you had a long list of very impressive credits already behind you. You played opposite Laurence Olivier with Coriolanus. You joined Judi Dench in Henry V. You were the first David Copperfield to meet us on our TV screens. The Henry V you did with Judi Dench, when you were combining your hearts and realms, I had a little look at it yesterday. You looked like you really were entering into the part with gusto. I'm thinking of particularly when it came to kissing her.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true. In fact, I'm always in and out of love. But that scene with Judy, I really had trouble with, because she was so delicious and played it so superbly. And as you said, I mean, the great joy of acting is getting into the part, whatever it is. That's why I love playing parts of people who've actually lived, like Henry V, Winston Churchill, whatever it may be, you know, because finding one's way in by whatever methods into the character so that you feel you know him, you feel you know how he walked, whatever, how he thought, is the joy of it, much more than actually messing about in front of the camera. But that scene with Judy had got me really hot under the collar.
Yes, well, she herself looked rather hot under the collar too, I have
did
to
she?
Say.
Well,
yes, she did.
That's two good actors at it.
Anyway, 30 years then since All Creatures Great and Small was first screened, and the BBC, we hear, are currently filming some more James Herriot stories for us to enjoy. Do you think it's a good idea for television to go back, or would you rather as an actor see them do new and fresh stuff?
Well, I think it's an interesting idea. And they won't let go now that they've at last realised it was a success. They won't take their teeth out of it.
You knew the character you played.
Oh, very well.
Yes. And is it indeed the case that his friends thought you got him bang on, but he just couldn't see it at all? He thought
he hated what I did, and so did his wife. We were great friends. We remain great friends. He said, now look here, when you're in Yorkshire, if you don't come and see me, I shall find out where you've been and I shall be very angry. So one day I rang him up when I was about an hour away and said, can I come and see you? And he said, you'll be late for lunch. Never mind, come along. I've got some good friends here. And I arrived and he was expatiating about how awful I was. So I asked him who he'd like to have done it. And he said, well, somebody with charm and good manners. I mean, really, if one thinks of it, Rex Harrison, I suppose. And I thought, well, there go I.
Yes, enough dead. Said.
But
yes.
As you kindly said, his friends used to come when they saw me being upset by his attacks. They would come and say, no, don't take any notice of him, you've got him.
Time for some music, Robert Hardy. Tell us what we're going to hear first off today.
A most wonderful number sung by Pearl Bailey from a production in 1955. In New York, which was a complete flop. It was directed by Peter Brook, A House of Flowers. But this is What Is a Friend For? From The House of Flowers.
What is a friend for? Should a friend bolt the door? When trouble knocks and the cradle rocks, is a friend just a metaphor for good times and nothing more? A friendship's never complete on a one-way street. Takes the two-way test to bring out the best. All the rest is just sheer badinage, only a mere mirage.
That was Pearl Bailey and What Is a Friend For? From the musical House of Flowers. So you have, as I said in the introduction, acquired this whole new audience with the Harry Potter movies. You played, of course, the Minister of Magic, Cornelius Fudge. In four of the films, we should remind people, of course, of the incredible cast that accompanied you. There was Maggie Smith, Robbie Coltrane, Miriam Margolyes, Julie Walters. It sounds like that must have been a blast, was it, working on those big movies?
Yes, it was, because so many of the people I was with, I knew pretty well. We behaved quite badly, I think, because we knew each other so well, but the result was okay. He was a fudgy politician, trying to play both ends down the middle.
What do you mean you behaved quite badly? What did you get
Well, we
to?
Used to be giggling, you know, and they, I think directors, one after another, got rather sick of us.
Is that why they kept changing the directors?
I think it probably was. Yeah.
You're 86 now, and you were written out earlier from the films than the character was in the books. Why was that?
Well, it's insurance that kicks old actors like me out of the game, because I mean, I was insured for over $1 million at some point, whether it was the last film or the one before, and they would have wanted to put it up, the insurers. So Warner Brothers, who was short of cash, of course, said very sadly... I mean, there was a day when three producers got onto a party telephone and rang me up and said, we don't know how we're going to say this. But I'd already sort of sussed it out and said, no, I know, you're going to sack me.
You mentioned when we were talking about Cornelius Fudge there that he was this sort of brilliant, fudgy politician managing both ends. And, of course, the politician that you are always associated with is Churchill, the BAFTA award-winning series, The Wilderness Years. Mm. How do you manage to nail it without it either being an impersonation or a parody? Where do you begin with that?
I fought and fought and fought not to do it. But I suggested masses of other people who might have done it.
Why did you not want to do it?
Well, I just didn't think I was anywhere near it. I just didn't think I had the capacity or anything.
The brilliant performance, a lot of it was in the jaw and the mouth. What did you have a sort of set to the jaw that you...
I had my dentist at that time knew about the dentist who dealt with Churchill. And he made me a plate, which fitted, so that I was constantly trying to overcome this slight thing. And there was a time when we were filming in America, and I took it out in the Arizona desert and put it down on the table. It was snatched almost immediately by one of those sort of wild dogs.
Right.
And that was the end of the plate, but I needed it. To begin with, there's something to overcome.
Fascinating. Let's have some music then. Our second disc of the day, Robert, what are we going to hear?
I'd like to hear the second movement of Beethoven's Seventh.
And tell me why you've chosen this.
Because when I was still at school, I got permission to go to a concert, I think it was in Leicester, where the London Philharmonic was playing the Bruch Violin Concerto No. 1, followed by the Beethoven Seventh. And I was so entranced by it that I went and saw them afterwards. And they said they were short of money, so I went back. And in my house at school, I managed to raise a smaller, tiny sum of money, which I sent to them in an envelope. And they were so thrilled. They said, "We're coming to play at your school. Would you like to choose the programme?" So away I went and I chose the Bruch Violin Concerto, followed by the Beethoven Sevens, and they kindly played it. It was simply thrilling.
The second movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony in A Major, performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Arturo Toscanini. That was recorded in 1935. I have a vision of you as this teenager. You say you're around about 15, 1940, and so you were so enthralled by what you'd heard that you raised the money. You were a passionate teenager then, were you?
I'm a passionate creature.
You are, aren't you? Yes.
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Being a passionate person can be a difficult thing to live with. Has it sort of ruled you through your life, do you think?
Oh, yes, it's hell. Absolute hell.
As an adult, you can kind of understand them and at least try to manage them a little, but as a child, that must have been quite tricky.
I think people found it extremely tricky. Yes, I mean, there was a time, I know, when I was sent to... No, advice was taken from. I never was actually confronted by an eminent psychiatrist. And it did no good, of course.
What were you doing to worry your parents to that degree?
I suppose... being rebellious, tiresome, exploding, you know, all sorts of things.
Right.
It's no use moaning about them now. It's too late, anyway.
Yes, I don't want you to moan about them, but I think it's an interesting way to live and often a very difficult way to live, to be a hostage to your passions like that.
Yes, I think you're right. Yes, nobody's ever been so forthright. I dare say the psychiatrist would have been. Have you ever thought of being a psychiatrist?
No, absolutely not.
I think you might be very good.
Well, in that case, tell me about your mother.
Oh, well, she was wonderful. She had to go through it all. But I think about her playing the violin, which she didn't do half badly.
Really? You were the youngest of six children.
Yeah.
Describe the household then to me. How did you get on at home?
I got on very well, really. I mean, being the youngest, I was spoilt, and all my siblings said, you're spoilt. And I dare say I was.
And so you went to school, you were sent to boarding school at what age? Around about eight, probably, was it?
Eight, I'm afraid, yeah.
Yes, and that made you sad and annoyed.
You bet.
Did it?
Yeah, it made me extremely sad.
Right.
I found that very upsetting. They said it was one of the best boarding schools, prep schools, as they were called, in the country, but I thought it was absolute hell.
And in those days, of course, you just would have to buck up your ideas, would you?
Yes. I mean, I wrote, I know, endless letters home begging to be reprieved, as one might write from prison.
Right.
But it was thought that it was better for me to grow up and face the music and all those good phrases.
You're a father of three yourself. I'm imagining you probably didn't send them to boarding school then, did you?
Not at that age.
Right.
No, they went locally.
Let's have some music then, Robert Hardy. Tell me about this third disc.
Enya, that extraordinary lady who recorded and over-recorded herself and then over-recorded again. And this makes me think of a time when I was passionately in love and played it again and again and again. But also it has a connection, because the piece I want played is called The Longships, and this has a Scandinavian connection. And I have... deep connections with Scandinavia.
That was Enya and the Long Ships, and we shall go from Long Ships to Longbows, Robert Hardy. It is a fascinating fact about you that around about 40 years ago you wrote a book on longbows that has never been out of print.
Yes, it's true.
Where did the fascination begin?
I think it began when I was about six, and I found two longbows in the attic, broken, and they weren't broken then, I broke them very swiftly. And I wanted to know all about it from then on.
So you had a go and you broke them, did you?
Yeah, I had a go and I broke them, yeah.
And now let me get this right. At the same time that you were busy filming All Creatures Great and Small, you were also asked, because of your historical knowledge and expertise, to be an advisor as the Mary Rose was being lifted from the seabed. Tell me about that.
Before she was lifted.
Right.
Because they emptied her first, you know.
Right.
And Margaret Rule, who was the spirit and drive behind the whole thing, she had on her desk piles of books covering every discipline she was going to have to learn about. And when the first one came up, somebody said, I think it's a pike staff. She took a look and said, no, it isn't, it's a longbow. Now, wait a minute, who is this man reaching for this first book I'd written? And she said, who is this man? Get hold of him. And I went down and saw the first longbow and the first arrows up from the Mary Rose. And I practically fainted with excitement. Eventually, they were handed over to me and I had 138 of them to look after, to clean, to investigate, to restore. I had them in my cellar, uninsured, for something like 8 years.
Quite a responsibility.
Well, yes, if you got worried about it, it was.
So it was rugby school and then on to Oxford and to study. You wanted to study history.
Yeah.
But you did, in fact, end up reading English. Why was
that?
Yes,
I did, because my tutor at school said, if you switch for your last year to English, you'll have C.S. Lewis as your tutor in college and J.R.R. Tolkien as your Anglo-Saxon tutor. So who wouldn't switch?
Yes, not bad names to bat about. How did you get on with both of them?
Loved them both.
What about Tolkien? Is it true that he taught you in the pub?
He did on several occasions, yes, he did. One magic occasion when he said, next week, Tuesday, 11 o'clock, in The Bird and Baby, which is The Eagle and Child. And I went past it the other day and the table in the window round which he sat us is still there. I was absolutely thrilled. I stopped and just gawped through the window. There it was in all the chairs we sat in. He ranged us in front of him with his back to the window and covered his eyes and made us talk one by one. Come on, don't be shy. I want to hear more, 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 more. Then he analysed us one by one, what part of the country we came from. It was an absolutely brilliant display. He said, now, you want to know why we played that parlour game, and the reason is because I want you to believe me when I say this is how Anglo-Saxon sounded. The Drochtomersch hath persed to the root, and bathed every vine in switch liqueur of which vertu engendered is the flour, and Zephyrus, etc., etc. And it was extraordinary, and of course one did believe him. That's Anglo-Saxon.
I know, if only I could speak Anglo-Saxon, we could do the whole of the rest of the programme in it.
Wouldn't that be fun? We'd need Tolkien, yeah.
I've just about got menu French, I'm sorry to tell you. I certainly don't have Anglo-Saxon. So let's have, instead, Robert Hardy, some music.
Can we have the waltz from the beginning of the, I suppose you'd call it the second movement, of Berlioz? I love Berlioz. His Symphonie Fantastique.
That was The Waltz from the Symphonie Fantastique by Berlioz with the Paris Orchestra conducted by Semyon Bychkov. You left Oxford then determined to become an actor. Where had that passion really begun?
I think at the beginning, I think I emerged as an actor, really. I think I was dissatisfied with what I'd found and decided to become other people.
What do you mean you were dissatisfied with what you found?
I didn't think much of myself.
Of yourself?
This baby is no good. I said, I want to be another one, a different one.
Why? Why were you dissatisfied?
I don't know. I just loved the idea of being other people. But I think one of my aunts was married when I was about 5, I suppose, and I was dressed in satin and was to hold the loop on one side of the end of a very long train, and a girl who I knew very well was to hold the loop at the other end, and then she had conniptions, I mean a complete sort of breakdown, refused to carry her bit of the train. So everybody turned round to me and said, spread your arms out. Oh, I think you can do it. So at full stretch, I walked down the aisle holding a loop in either hand with my head held high, and as I went, every eye was turned towards me, and something inside me said, that's it. Get every eye on you.
And so you emerged from Oxford with this, and you did say a shabby degree. What did you get, a third?
Yes, I got a third, yeah.
Right.
That's because I was acting. That was coming back after the war, and I did nothing but act.
You were part of that generation, of course, we should remind people, whose studies were interrupted by the war. You left Oxford to train with the RAF. By the time you came back, the bomb had been dropped on...
The bomb had been dropped.
...on Nagasaki, and you didn't see active service. Yeah. And how did your parents welcome the news that their son wanted to be an actor?
Oh, well, they were perfectly calm about it.
Did they come to watch?
Yes. And when I rather startled London, playing Prince Hal at the Old Vic in 1953, I think it was, something like that, they were both thrilled. Sparkling eyes and all that, you know. Surprise, surprise.
Let's have some music then, Robert Hardy. Our fifth disc of the day is what?
Well, this is the one piece that's left. I find it so difficult. I'm sure all your victims, all your friends...
Thank you for that.
...who join you find it really difficult. In my case, it's difficult because my head is constantly full of music.
Right.
But this piece, which is by Francis Poulenc from his Petite Suite Française, was written specifically for the theatre, which is one of the reasons why it's included. Also, it makes me cry every time I hear it. The play was called La Reine Margot.
The Sicilienne from Poulenc's Suite Française, performed by the National Orchestra of France, conducted by Charles Dutroit. You have said, Robert Hardy, that you believe that an actor has to be stripped down, clean as a rocket, and must have no other interest. Do you stand by that?
I've said many, many foolish things in my life, and that, I think, is probably among the most foolish, because, in fact, the more accretions that an actor can achieve, the better actor he's likely to be.
One of your best friends was Richard Burton, who you met at Oxford. What was he like as a young man?
Oh, absolutely compelling. An extraordinary man. Actually, that quote about stripping down being a rocket was in a letter I wrote to Richard.
Yes.
I wrote him endless letters on that sort of theme, which he very patiently endured, but I think they must have bored him to death, because he was instinctive, speedy, quick, passionate in a totally different way from me.
And you went on, you shared a house at one point, didn't you, with Richard Burton and his first wife, Sybil, is that right?
Yeah, well, I used to be there a lot.
Oh, you were? OK.
We didn't actually share a house.
Oh, I see. And how did you get on? What was it? I mean, you know...
Oh, wonderfully. I adored Sybil.
Right.
So that when the Elizabeth Taylor thing came along, I found it pretty difficult to accept.
When did you first meet Elizabeth Taylor? Can you remember?
Yes, I remember vividly. I was at home in my house in London then, and a familiar voice came on the telephone. Hello, it's Rich. I've got a friend here who wants to speak to you. Hand it over. Hello, Tim. My friends and family know me as Tim, which is one of my names.
Right.
She said, I want to come and have supper with you, Rich and me. It's Elizabeth Taylor. And round they came. And, of course, I realised I must have been extremely frosty, because as she got into the car at the end of the evening to go away, she clasped my hands in hers and said, don't hate me, Tim.
Did she fix you with those violet eyes?
Absolutely.
And as you saw your very good friend get whipped up into this... I mean, let's not forget, they make Brad and Angelina look like a vicarage tea party. I mean, they were the only show in town.
They were.
As you saw that happen to your good friend, the jewels, the yachts, the paparazzi, the whole thing, did you fear for him?
Yes, I did. And the more it went on, the more I realised that it was going to be his undoing. And in the end, I think it's true that it was his undoing. That sort of life killed him in a way.
Let's have some music then, Robert Hardy. Your sixth of the morning. What are we going to hear now?
I love Sibelius and this particular piece. There's a touch of the Sibelius and the stretching forests and lakes of his Finland, and then suddenly he turns in this piece sort of back to the 18th century. It's wonderful.
That was the fourth movement of Sibelius's Sixth Symphony in D minor, performed by the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. When was the last time you performed on stage?
I played for the seventh time Winston Churchill in Paris, in French, in 2000, and it was the most wonderful production called Celui qui a dit non, and it was a play about De Gaulle, Churchill and the French Resistance.
You said a while ago that you had initially turned down playing Winston Churchill in the wilderness years. Was there something of almost revering somebody too much that it was an intimidating role to take on?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That was it. Just wasn't up to it.
Do you feel you understood him?
Yes. More and more and more. I got to know him. He became a friend. And, of course, that was the thing, really. Not only did I revere him enormously, but he was our friend in the war, because he took all of us by the hand and led us through those dark and dreadful days.
And has he kept you company in a way? Do you sometimes?
Yes. And so his family have forgiven me, most of them anyway. And when I was doing him, so to say, in Paris, Lady Soames had said to me, oh, you must go, it's just been unveiled. It's the best statue of Papa. You simply must go and see it.
This was his youngest daughter, of course.
His youngest daughter. So I did. And as it approached, daubed right across this great big plinth in dripping scarlet paint was L'Assassin de Mers el Kébir. In other words, the murderer of Mers el Kébir, where we, the Royal Navy, destroyed the French fleet. Mm. And I went back to rehearsal and said to Robert Sen, who was the director, I said, God, I'm a bit alarmed about this. And he said, oh, well, you will have trouble. First thing you'll hear when we're out in front of the audience is seats tipping up as you come on, and then you'll hear booing, and they may throw things, they might even shoot. And I said, Robert, I don't want to die. And he said, oh, but for an actor, what a way to go.
Very glad you're here now. Let's have some more music, Robert Hardy. We're on our seventh disc of the day.
Beethoven again, two Beethovens, but are you surprised? It's string quartet in B-flat and an extraordinary, unusual, rather like the Sibelius, in the midst of a very heavy, deeply passionate, philosophical piece, comes this extraordinary little dance movement.
The Medici String Quartet playing the second movement of Beethoven's String Quartet in B-flat. Talking a moment ago, Robert Hardy, about Mary Soames, now Baroness Soames, of course, the youngest daughter of Winston Churchill. When she first learned that you were to play her father, was she all-embracing in her enthusiasm?
I have no idea, because we met first when she came. We were filming at Chartwell, and there were cables and wet and crew with muddy boots tramping in and out of the house, her house, you know, into which she was born and grew up. And she was obviously distressed. And I said, this is all horrid, it'll all be put right. Don't be depressed by it. Would you like a whiskey? Come into my trailer. And she said, oh, yes, I would. And we went and had a whiskey. And then she started evaluating me. She said, the bow ties, that's about right. That's a good suit, yes. And then she said, where'd you get that? And seized my finger, third finger of my right hand. And I'd had his ring copied by Garrard, who had records of what his ring was, with the two crests, Spencer and Churchill. And she was absolutely amazed that an actor should go to that trouble.
You've been married twice then, and yeah. you've spent the last 20-odd years single on paper, at least, not married.
Correct.
Do you ever get lonely?
No, I don't. I never have succumbed much to loneliness. Now I've got abreast of the problem of being with myself. I quite approve of what has emerged. The thing that I am has so many interests. There's never a dull moment.
You've got four grandchildren of your own.
Yes.
Do you see much of them?
Yes, I see as much of my family as I possibly can.
I'm imagining you do occasionally bump into Dame Judi Dench.
Oh, yes, I did the other day at Buckingham Palace. Yeah.
Do you ever talk about the old days?
I did. I told her something which I can't really say on this program,
go on.
I think. I said the love scene, Henry V, which we did. I remember, she said, that was the only time in a love scene when I had trouble with my hose.
Very elegantly put. Shall we have our final piece then? We're on disc 8. What are we going to hear, Robert Hardy?
This is the sort of final bit of a work called De Profundis, which is composed by a nephew of mine, John Hardy, who's a very fine composer. And I think it very appropriate for somebody who's obviously going to perish on the desert island, because nobody would think it worthwhile to come and rescue an old man of my years. And I'm very happy and proud to have, after some difficulty, have achieved this recording from Westminster Abbey.
De Profundis by John Hardy, performed at Westminster Abbey with the Abbey Choir, the BBC Singers and London Brass, conducted by Martin Baker. So, Robert, I'm going to give you the books, of course. You get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you're going to take along which book to join them?
Well, it sounds totally egotistical, but I'm going to take along a book of which I'm the co-author, because it's an enormous book, a sort of book of reference, if you like, for the whole history of famous longbow in military history in England and France. And I did it with a marvellous man, the professor of medieval history at Glasgow University, Professor Strickland. And there's so much in all of it which really I need to go back on, because it's been half my life.
Right, you may have that, of course, and a luxury too.
I want a sub-Leonardo da Vinci portrait by a man called Da Predi, who was a friend and pupil of Leonardo's, and the great experts, you know what they're like, say, no, it's certainly not Leonardo, it's Da Predi. You can see by its stiffness it's not Leonardo. Anyway, I want the one, partly because I think it's absolutely beautiful, and partly because I grew up with a copy of it at home, and it is Young Lady in Profile by Da Predi.
That perfect female head is yours then. And if you had to choose just one of the eight discs that we've heard here today, which one would you like to choose?
Oh, I suppose it would be the Beethoven Quartet, but I'd want the whole of it. That's the answer.
Robert Hardy, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
It's been the greatest pleasure. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.